Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Lori Wagner, a member of the club's LGBT Forum and your chair for today. We also welcome our listeners on the radio and we invite our audience to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Joanne Keatley. Joanne is the director of the Center of Excellence for Transgender HIV Prevention and the Minority Programs Manager of Pacific AIDS Education and Training Center at UCSF. She has chaired San Francisco Transgender Empowerment, Advocacy and Membership, SF Team, and has consulted on transgender health at the national level for such entities as the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Health Resources and Services Administration, and the Center for Substance Abuse Treatment, as well as the Obama Transition Team, among others. She was appointed to the California Department of Public Health Office of AIDS Latino Advisory Board and serves as co-chair of the Board of Directors of the grassroots AIDS organization Salva Sida. At UCSF, she has served on the Chancellor's Advisory Committee for LGBT Issues since 1990 and this year was awarded the UCSF Martin Luther King Jr. Award, which recognizes exceptional leadership. These are only a few of her accomplishments and commitments. Through her professionalism and integrity, Joanne has advocated successfully for transgender health within existing institutions, and with her generosity of spirit has extended this advocacy, sharing her own story and reaffirming the common humanity we all share. It's my pleasure now to turn the program over to her.
Thank you so much, Lori, for that warm introduction, and thank you for being here tonight. It's always hard not to blush when people are talking about me, but I did want to start today with sharing a film with you. It's called Transforming Healthcare. It's a short film, about 17 minutes long, and I'll probably stop it before the end of the film. The reason I wanted to share this film with you is that it's particularly poignant in that it shares a number of transgender individuals' stories about accessing healthcare. And since the topic today was on healthcare disparities among transgender populations, I thought that it was very appropriate for this talk. I also wanted to share with you that the person who put this film together actually did it as a class project. He did it as part of his master's work at San Francisco State. And so we're very proud of him for having had the initiative to put together this film. And I think that you will appreciate it. So we'll start off with that film, and then I'll take over after the film and share with you some perspectives that I have about what's wrong with the health system for transgender populations and, some of the work that I've been up to and maybe how you can get involved as well. So, we know what's in here because we tried it beforehand. Here we go. Everyone hear that?
Usually work at this point. I got your pediatrics. I don't know what to do with your body. I would just have you stand here. If you were a girl, I would have you lay down on the table. She's like, fine, I don't know what to do with you. And she was perfect. She was like, right up front. And I was like, and I didn't know what to say. I was like, I don't know how to don't know what you're looking for. I don't know what you want me to do.
Let's get some audio. Well, volume is up all the way, so I think we'll wait for the IT. Sorry about that. Okay. So maybe we can begin. Let's see here. He's coming? Okay.
I always knew there was never any question for me. As to maybe on this, maybe on that.
Okay. Well, you can always count on some technical difficulty, right? So, in the meantime, maybe I can just begin with a little overview. So how many people are familiar with the term transgender? That's, you know, one place where we could start. Any idea? So everyone here is familiar with the term transgender. And any, would you care to share with us what your notion of transgender is? Any volunteers? Everybody's shaking their head. You're all shy?
Someone whose gender identity differs from their birth sex.
Okay. Someone whose gender identity differs from their birth sex. Okay. That's a good one. What I like to say is that someone transgender, a transgender person, is someone whose gender identity differs from the sex that was assigned to them at birth. And the reason that I say that, you know, why I say the sex assigned to them at birth is that my sense is that lots of people's sex is misassigned at birth. We know that in nature, there is the condition of intersexuality, and there are people who are intersex who are assigned either male or female at birth. Oftentimes, it may be incorrect for them. And then for transgender people, the process of assigning one's sex at birth is pretty simplistic, actually. The way that people's sex is assigned at birth is by a visual examination by the physician. And so the first, you know, thing that happens when a child is born is that the person delivering the baby, you know, whether it's the physician, the nurse, the midwife, whoever is assisting in the birth, will take a look at the genitalia of the baby and make a determination based on that visual examination. And so, my claim is that sometimes that assignment may not be appropriate. And so I always like to refer to that as assigned it at birth. So there is a difference between transgender people, right, and transsexual people. and many other identities that exist within the transgender community and world. There are just as many ways to identify within the transgender community as, you know, there are probably, you know, plants on the planet. We have a slide that I didn't prepare any PowerPoint slides for you tonight because I thought that it would be better to just have a conversation with you. And so I do have a slide that just goes on ad nauseum with, you know, hundreds of ways in which people identify themselves. I do advocate for people's self-determination and people's right to identify in the way that's comfortable for them and feels right and makes them feel, you know, comfortable in their own skin. And so so I agree with the notion that people should self-identify. I also, as a person that works in public health, think that we have to be able to kind of categorize people in certain categories so that we can have a sense of health issues that affect you know, a group of people that have some commonalities. And I think that's, there's a little discourse in the community sometimes around that because there are many of us who don't feel comfortable with identifying as trans or transgender or transsexual or genderqueer or any of the other ways in which we identify. But yet, if we ever hope to achieve equity in the healthcare arena, we need to be able to come together as a community and unify and advocate for one another's health needs. And the only way to do that is to really have a way to, you know, capture the commonalities across the different identities. It's a little bit of, you know, a challenge to get everyone to buy into that notion, but I haven't lost faith that it will happen. So, any word from the IT folks? No? Oh, there he is. All right. I apologize for this, but I think that the DVD will inform our conversation more. Before we get this issue resolved, maybe we can talk a little bit about one of the ways in which transgender people seek healthcare, because tonight's topic is around access to healthcare. So, cross-gender hormones, and are you all familiar with the concept of cross-gender hormones? No? Okay. So, hormones are the way in which trans people typically seek healthcare, right? They seek an affirmation of their identity through medical technologies, often, in order to have their bodies confirmed to, you know, affirm their sense of self. Now, not all trans people seek a medical intervention. Certainly not all trans people seek a surgical intervention. And not all trans people are comfortable with the, you know, with the notion of altering their bodies in any kind of way. Many of us do, and we'll pursue that. My sense is that if you are seeking that, that you should, you know, that we have a right to be able to access those kinds of services, those medical technologies. Great, those medical technologies that will affirm our sense of self. And for those of us that are seeking them, they should be available. So I'll stop there, and hopefully we're...
A question for me.
Can you hear it?
Is to, maybe I'm this, maybe I'm that.
I'd like to start
from
the start.
Even though, as I got older, my body was...
And then we'll... Almost there.
There was one time in particular where I went to get STD testing, and the woman was like, I've never met a transgender person, ever. I don't usually work at this clinic. I do pediatrics. I don't know what to do with your body. Like, you know, if you were a guy, I would just have you stand here. If you were a girl, I would have you lay down on the table. She's like, but I don't know what to do with you. And she was perfect. She was, like, right up front about it. And I was like, and I didn't know what to say. Like, I was like, I don't know how to do your job. I don't know what you're looking for. I don't know what you want me to do. And she didn't know what to do either, so we were just kind of like, take this. And then I left. And I was pissed that I didn't get healthcare. I didn't, like, receive any healthcare.
I always knew. There was never any question for me as to maybe I'm this, maybe I'm that. Even though as I got older, my body was different from what I had imagined it to be. In my mind, I was always a little boy, and I was always treated like a little boy by just about everyone in my family.
I became aware that I was different when I was probably about 2 years old. I've always identified myself as being female in spirit.
I identify as transgender. I actually don't necessarily identify as male or female, but I definitely move toward more towards, like, if you want to call it a spectrum, but more towards a masculine identified, but not necessarily as one or the other. I remember when I was, like, about three or four years old growing up in Louisiana, I got, like, a great bowl cut and was walking around, and everybody kept asking me if I was a boy or a girl, and I would answer as a boy. And then I think that kind of threw my mom off, so she kept putting dresses on me.
First, I wanted to be a woman. Then I realized that I could never really be a biological woman. And then I came to the other side where I realized, why do I even have to be? And finally, I realized I'm a transgendered woman, and that's great. I think there's nothing wrong with me. What's going on here is that something's wrong with the world.
I think transgender people in general are very fearful of going to a medical provider. It's very vulnerable. You don't know if you're going to be flatly rejected, or someone's going to laugh at you, if someone's going to over-sexualize you, if someone's going to want to do an exam just to see your genitals, just to satisfy their own curiosity. There are lots of humiliating experiences that people have, and those get shared with other trans people, and people end up avoiding their medical care altogether.
Myself, I went in once for bronchitis. And I disclosed that I was transgender. And the next thing I know, I'm in the ER. I went to the ER for services because I had a high fever. And I didn't feel comfortable in going to the doctors regularly because there was nothing trans-specific here. And I ended up under a spotlight with my legs wide open and a group of doctors looking at my vagina because they all were curious to understand what my body looked like. But I initially went in for bronchial stuff. So there's no congruence there for providing care.
So it had been a while since I gotten the junk checked out, and I really felt like I needed to get, like, an annual in order to just, you know, do my own kind of health maintenance. I was waiting for a while, and the practitioner came in, and She's like, oh, how long has it been since your last exam of, you know, your last pelvic exam? And I said, oh, it's been probably like over 10 years maybe. And she's like, wow. You know, she was astounded. And she's like, well, welcome back to being a woman. And I said, I was like, you know, I was a little bit taken aback. Like, I feel like in that case, she assumed that her identity as a woman was going to be my identity as a woman just because I was in that clinic and getting the particular exam that I was getting. But that's not true. You know, I can identify as I want to. I can identify as transgender. I can identify as male. But, and I can still go in and get that exam. Yeah, I can still have a period, but I'm still male. I'm still transgender. I can be whoever I want. So don't place your identification with your gender onto me.
Every single time I go to see somebody, I have to come out, and then I have to educate them on what I'm talking about when I come out. The assumption is that if I say I'm a transsexual, then I must be a male to female. And the first is, well, you know, why don't you try to talk a little higher so that people, and you should get that stuff off your face. I mean, that, who's going to believe you? And you don't sit dainty like, what? I don't understand. So then I have to explain that the existence of FTMs. And then I have to explain that we aren't all doing certain things. I remember one time I had pneumonia, and the x-ray tech kept, I don't know how, oh, because he had to read my file. And he started asking me questions. First of all, he started saying, Miss Lewis, and I said, it's not Miss Lewis, it's Mr. But then also asking me a question, so you're taking testosterone, and what effect do you think that might have had on your pneumonia? And me saying, none. I don't think it had any effect.
Medically, to provide cross-gender hormones is incredibly simple, but transgender people don't just need hormones. They need full-scope medical care just like everyone else. And if they take hormones, it doesn't mean that the rest of their lives are any more complicated from a medical perspective, and we should stop being so afraid to address transgender people's needs.
Well, you have to admit that you're having sex, and you might.
Just when it was getting to the good stuff, right? So, Lori Kohler, who's the physician that was on that film, talks about cross-gender hormones, and that's what I was speaking about before I started playing the film, when you could hear it. So cross-gender hormones, as I said, are one of the ways, one of the medical interventions that transgender people will seek out. But it's not the only medical, or it's not the only intervention for trans people. And so often my experience is that trans people will seek out the therapy, the intervention that is correct for them, and then, you know, they are then led to a quality of life that is better than what was, you know, what was in existence prior to obtaining that. So sometimes they may decide not to take cross-gender hormones for a variety of reasons. For example, one of the effects of estrogen, which is the cross-gender hormone that trans women typically take, is that it does impact the libido, and it will impact the ability to maintain an erection. And so if you are a trans woman and you are having sexual relationships with your partner who accepts your body for the way that it is, then you may not want to forego, you know, having erections because, you know, you and your partner are enjoying that part of your anatomy. And so many trans women will then opt for another medical intervention, something like, you know, perhaps some kind of you know, facial feminization surgery in order to obtain facial features that are more in line with their sense of self, their feminine self, or they may get breast implants to augment their breasts and still maintain a feminine body but have, you know, usage of their genitalia. And so I am one for personal choice, and I feel like we need to to provide whatever therapies are going to work for the individual, and you know, and provide for choices. And the other thing to consider is that trans people may opt for just not having any intervention at all. They may decide that their bodies are just fine the way they are. Leave my genitalia alone. Don't mess with it. I don't need to conform to any, you know, to society's views of what it is to be male or female in order to feel like a man or a woman, like one of the characters on the film, or one of the persons on the film said, you know, don't put your identity on me. Let me be me. But for those people who do take cross-gender hormones, there is an issue to consider, and that is the fact that cross-gender hormones continue to be off-label use in this country. And the reason for that is that there have not been any clinical trials to use hormones, you know, to determine what is the long-term effect of taking cross-gender hormones for in bodies that they were not designed to be used with. And so we actually, medical personnel, physicians, they glean a lot of information from studies that have been done either abroad or studies that were done with, say, for example, non-transgender women, and they look at, you know, estrogen's effect on non-transgender women, and then they try to apply what's been learned in those studies to transgender women, and it's just not accurate to interpret that data in the same way. Our bodies are, you know, our biology is different, and so the effects of the estrogens or the effects of the testosterone on different body people is going to be not what it was with the with people that those medications were designed for usage with. So there is a problem with that. The other problem is that because they are off-label, many physicians will be hesitant to use off-label drugs. And so, if you are familiar with physicians, they're always concerned about liability and about their licenses and those kinds of things. And so there's for physicians that are considering providing cross-gender hormones, you have to kind of hold hands and assure them, you know, that there has been a history of providing cross-gender hormones for trans people in this country, and that the complications of the providing those cross-gender hormones is, you know, up for debate. We don't know of any, you know, specific long-term damage that they've caused, but it would be wonderful if we could get some drug companies to actually put some funds into providing some clinical studies so we actually have a sense of, you know, what effect those will have on our bodies instead of being guinea pigs for continued use of off-label drugs. So I advocate for, you know, some research money from somewhere. I'm asking the universe to provide it, but we'll see if it actually happens. One other issue to consider is that often trans people who are seeking health care receive health care that is culturally insensitive at times and less than optimal in terms of quality. We are often, what happens in the trans community often is that we'll find, you know, one trans person will seek out health care from some doctor who has never treated trans people before. And then they will educate that doctor based on anecdotal information that they've either gotten off the web or they've gotten from through their friends or they've read, right? And so then, you know, the doctor buys the argument and starts treating that patient. And then if that patient feels like this doctor is responsive to their needs and is sensitive to their needs and, you know, open to treating you, then that patient will tell their friends, and through word of mouth, the word gets out on the street, and then people start going to that doctor. Because even in our fair city of San Francisco, there's only a handful of physicians that provide health care to the trans community in this city. And, you know, we are the leading center, the leading urban center for transgender health. And there's only a handful in this city. In California, just to give you an idea, in California, there are only three surgeons that specialize in gender-confirming procedures. Three surgeons. You know, we're 34 million people in the state. There's three surgeons here. So, and we are, as I said, the leading, you know, people look to California and to San Francisco and Los Angeles to be the leaders in this field. So transgender people are often made to take on the role of physician educator, even if that knowledge is based on anecdotal information, like I said, or information that was shared by their friends and may not be accurate. So as a result, you know, we know that there can be complications as a result of that. Trans people will often, over self-medicate because there's an urgency to have their sense of self affirmed, right? So they may seek medical intervention from a physician. They may also seek medical intervention through the underground market and obtain, hormones on the street or through their friends or, you know, other sources off the internet, you know. Go to Mexico and you can buy them, you know, from a pharmacy without a prescription. You can bring them back into this country. You can get them through the internet or in Canada as well. So trans people often do self-medicate in addition to seeing physicians. Lori Kohler, the physician that was on the DVD, what she likes, this is a quote of hers that I love to use because it's so right on. What she says is that transgender people, regardless of socioeconomic status, are the most underserved people, in this country. Regardless of socioeconomic status. And the reason for that is what I was just talking about. In this state, we have three surgeons, you know, that are able to apply surgical technology for trans people. Right? And a handful of people in San Francisco, there is no medical school curricula that addresses our needs. If it's taught in the medical schools, it's only through maybe, you know, an afterthought in an LGBT elective, perhaps. You might get 10 minutes or 15 minutes of transgender health. And students are getting information that maybe, like, the professor has identified, like, a trans person in the community to come in and talk. And so that trans person is going to tell their story, their personal story, put their personal story out there. But the healthcare is not the same for every person. And so the physicians are not getting trained. They're hearing a compelling story and someone's need, but they're not getting the mechanics of providing care for that trans community. As Yosenio on the DVD mentioned, you know, not all trans people are trans women or M2F, as he said, and there are lots of trans men who have medical needs as well as the trans women's community. And, you know, we need to make sure that all trans people have access to that care. Another issue to consider, I'm just throwing out all these issues, and we'll talk later. So another issue to consider is health insurance policies. So health insurance policies on the open market, if you're a trans person and you disclose on that health insurance policy application that you are trans, guess what? You're not getting that policy. You are not getting that policy. And if you get that policy, it's going to be full of exclusions. Okay? The exclusions are going to be around your trans health care. Now, we are living in a city that has some progressive health plans, like Kaiser in San Francisco. So there's lots of people here in the city that are successfully accessing health care. But often, if you have a private insurer, your provider is having to be creative in their charting in order to have reimbursement for that procedure or that medication or that exam. Typically, anything that's related to being trans is going to be excluded in that policy. And if they do provide it for you after you've disclosed that you're trans, the cost is going to be prohibitive. And so back to Lori's comment about being regardless of socioeconomic status. And then the fact that there's not enough trained physicians in the state to take care of our needs. Not only in the state, there's just not enough physicians in the country to take care of our needs. We have it bad enough in California. Imagine what it's like in Montana if you're trans. It's just a little more difficult. You just have to go across the bridge to find out how difficult it is. In Alameda County, there's one physician down in South County in Fremont, Tri-City Health Center, that that is providing cross-gender hormones. So there are some isolated physicians that have like maybe some patients, a few patients here and there, but no one that's advertising their services or anything like that. It's a whole different picture outside of San Francisco. And then employer-based health insurance. So we are fortunate in San Francisco and in California that we do have a couple of large employers that have extended trans health benefits in their health insurance policies. One being the city and county of San Francisco. They led the way. And then UCSF, I'm proud to say, not only UCSF, but actually University of California has extended trans health benefits system-wide. And we're very proud of that. We had to do it incrementally, and we extended first coverage for cross-gender hormones and for mental health services. And then a year or two after we had extended those medical benefits, we were able to access the surgical benefit for all of our trans faculty and staff. And then recently, a year and a half ago, UCSF extended through their student health plan, now is offering surgical benefits for their trans students. So we are leading the way here at UCSF, or at UCSF here in San Francisco, and at the University of California as well. But most employer-based health insurance excludes trans health benefits. And what's sad to say is that for the large employers, in order to provide health insurance for trans people, it would add maybe, less than a dollar per person, in the health plan. For a large employer like, say, General Motors, for example, it would be negligible, the cost, to provide those types of benefits. There is actuary information from the city and county of San Francisco that shows that they actually, when they extended trans health benefits, they started charging their members, I think it was about a dollar more per person for the health plan, and they accrued millions of dollars surplus because it just, not every trans person is seeking surgical intervention, quite frankly. And so that's what the cost was based on. They thought that every trans person, once the benefit was extended, would seek surgical intervention. That's just not the case. So mental health diagnoses, I know we're almost out of time, right?
Okay.
So another issue to consider is that in order to access healthcare, you still need to have a diagnosis, by and large, outside of this progressive area of San Francisco, you still need to have a mental health diagnosis, the gender identity disorder, which is in the DSM-IV, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Health Disease. And it's just wrong, in my mind, to have a mental health diagnosis in order to obtain a medical treatment. The thought was, when this category was created in the DSM, was that it would provide a billable mechanism so that, you know, providers would be able to have a code that they would enter, and then the insurance companies would pay for the procedure because there was a, you know, diagnostic criteria. When in fact what happens is that anything related to that diagnosis is excluded from insurance policies. It has become the reason for denial of coverage. So the other thing with that diagnosis is that it creates a barrier to employment. For example, if you have a mental health diagnosis, you can't get security clearance if you want to work for the federal government. You know, any large employer can, you know, do a search and find that information out and can deny you employment based on a mental health disorder. So I think we have to be very careful with that diagnostic criteria, and I advocate for a medical diagnosis if the person is seeking a medical intervention. There's issues with faith-based service providers who deny trans people access to facilities and care. There was a recent case in South County, in South San Francisco, of a trans person who was scheduled for surgery, a pre-operative transsexual woman. She was scheduled to have breast augmentation in this facility, and you know, everything was fine until the day of the surgery. They discovered that she had male genitalia. And so when this was discovered, they decided that they didn't provide surgical procedures for that type of person. She was denied the surgery. That day, she was sent back home. And there is a case pending for that incident. Another big issue that we struggle with, particularly at the Center of Excellence for HIV Prevention, is that the Centers for Disease Control, which is responsible for collecting data on different, you know, diseases and prevalence, still uses the risk categories that are not inclusive of transgender people. So for trans women who do have high incidence rates for HIV, they're still counted in the what's called the men who have sex with men category. And so that's very problematic in many ways, the least of which is that HIV/AIDS funding for programs is based on the data, the prevalence, right? And so if we have no idea how many trans women and men are living with HIV in this country, then how do we carve out dollars for service programs to meet those people's needs when we don't know how many exist? We know from local needs assessments and epidemiological reports that have been conducted by public health departments where, you'd have to be blind not to see that it's impacting a certain segment of the population. In San Francisco, for example, back in 1999, there was a study by Kristen Clements-Knoll who looked at trans people here in the city and looked at trans women and men and came up with an overall prevalence rate of 35%. She had a study that was over 500 people, and 35% of those 500 and some people were HIV positive. So you can imagine, if we're losing all of that data and not counting in other areas, the impact that it's having on service programs. So, I'll wrap it up.
Why don't you just do questions in form, like if I took
a question? Okay, sure. Okay. So, do you want me to wrap it up now?
Yeah,
we
need to
get
a
okay. All right, so just two minutes. I'll wrap up. Okay. So, Lori had asked me to share with you a brief report back on the team meeting with the transition team in Washington, D.C. And so I could share with you that on December the 17th, I was invited to participate in a meeting in Washington, D.C. with the Obama and Biden transition team. There were actually Parag Mehta and three other members of the transition team were present, along with Rebecca Fox, the director of the National Coalition for LGBT Health, and Judy Bradford from Fenway, and Rob Garofalo from Howard Brown in Chicago, and a number of other pretty well-known researchers in the United States to discuss the issues of LGBT health and, you know, what the Obama-Biden transition team could do for us in this country. And I'm happy to say that, you know, we advocated for a number of things. We had over a dozen items on our wish list. One of them, of course, was around sexual orientation and gender identity, non-discrimination. And I am happy to report back that not too long after our meeting, actually in January, when the whitehouse.gov website came live after the transition of our new president, sexual orientation and gender identity were included in the non-discrimination policies on the White House website, which I was so thrilled with because it's the first time in the history of our country that we have a president who actually is knowledgeable about trans populations, and I think that we can trust to make a difference, not only for trans people, but for LGBT people. So that concludes my comment. I'm going to be taking questions, and I know that I shared a lot of gloom and doom, right? But it's not all gloom and doom. We are making some progress. So, yes. That you asked that question, because I do have my website on a little card on your seat there. We have a website. It's www.transhealth.ucsf.edu, and on that website you can request a training at your facility, and we have faculty on staff that can come out and do physician training. We're happy to do that, actually, and we're based at the Pacific AIDS Education Training Center, and so if we don't have a physician or a nurse on staff that is familiar with your particular, you know, area of practice, then we can contract with someone and send you a team of people to deliver a training that is tailored to your specific needs. Yes. You're welcome. We're happy to provide that. I beg your pardon?
The first question.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think that we are making progress in that area. There has been a lot of awareness raised around, the fact that the gender binary is too confining, even for non-transgender people. And I think that we have made tremendous progress in the last probably 20, 25 years in this country in terms of acceptance of non-gender conformance, non-binary gender conformance. So I think that we are making progress. I don't know that we'll ever be at a place where we don't have, you know, some sense of kind of maleness and femaleness and, you know, what that means. But I think that society is becoming more open to some variance, and I'm happy to see that. I don't know how we can let go of all of the kind of gender expectations. They're so ingrained from the very beginning. You know, I have a friend who works for the city and county of San Francisco, Marcus. Well, he goes by Holy Old Man Bull now, but he always shares the story of, you know, the first thing that anybody does when a baby is born is ask the question, what is it, right? And the response is, it's a boy or it's a girl. And so right from the very start, you know, you have to be classified in some box that society has decided you belong in. And so I'm not sure if we'll ever be in a place where we can just let go of all of the gender traps. But I think by attending these kinds of talks and by seeking out additional training, you know, and sharing information with each other, we can make some progress. I'm hopeful.
You mentioned that there's not a lot of data out there in terms of, especially around HIV, HIV incidents and where the risk high risk populations are and access issues. I'm wondering for new issues, emerging issues around HIV, where does the knowledge reside? I mean, if it's not the data, where can that knowledge bubble up from? Mm-hmm. So across, in our case, California, mm-hmm. you know, that information, people who have that information can somehow come together mm-hmm. and share that knowledge in order to create interventions and advocacy. Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of information on the website. We have a library on the website with, with all of the current articles and all of the needs assessments that have been conducted around the country. There is recently there was a meta-analysis that Jeff Herbst at the CDC conducted. He looked at 29 different studies throughout the country. Actually, one of them was a study that Don and I worked on. Donald Ferrario is here in the audience. But he included that study that we worked on at UCSF. But he looked at 29 studies, and the four studies that collected data and actually tested the participants of the studies, it came up with a 28% overall prevalence rate for those four studies. And then the remaining 25 studies in that sample were by self-report. And so by self-report, it was 12%. So what that told me was that there's a big discrepancy between what we know, you know, when we test trans people and determine what their status is and when they self-report, because they're not being tested out in the community, and we're not reaching trans people. But I would start on our website. I think, you know, we are, we've been funded by the State Office of AIDS to build that website so that there is a central location of information to access. And so we have different categories of information you can access there. There are... there's only a few people that are specializing in this area. There's Don is conducting a study right now. And then there's Jessica Xavier has done quite a bit of work, Walter Bochting, Judy Bradford. So that's about it in this country. There's only a few. San Francisco Department of Public Health continues to do local needs assessments. But, it doesn't tell us the picture for California. So, yes?
DSM-5 is due in a few years. I'm wondering if you have any sense of how the definitions might be changing for that.
Oh, boy, I wish I could answer that in a positive way. But There was a committee of people that were named to be on the committee to look at the diagnostic criteria for GID. And some of the people that were named were, how can I put this kindly, not well thought of in the trans community because they have been known to engage in reparative therapy with children. And so there was a lot of discourse around their selection for that committee. Now, there were other people on the committee that I know and trust, and so I'm hoping that my colleagues were able to effectively advocate for some revision of the diagnostic criteria. I don't see it being removed. I see it being refined, and the diagnostic criteria being rewritten, but I don't see it removed in DSM-5. I think there's the mental health community, unfortunately, is too dependent on that diagnostic criteria to continue to exist. There's a lot of, just like in HIV and AIDS, there's an HIV and AIDS industry. There's also a mental health industry, and I think that, it is the source of some lucrative practices. So I don't see it being removed. Don?
Yeah, it's a question / comment. I hope it's not too polarizing. But I've noticed that a lot of the research that's come out on trans individuals has revolved around HIV.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, a lot of the medical attention is specific to trans women.
Right.
Leaving trans guys out of the public health conversation.
Right.
So what do you know that's going on that's bringing more attention to the problem of trans guys?
Yeah.
Where HIV, we think, is less of an issue compared to trans women.
Right.
How can we get trans guys?
I love that you said, we think it's less of an issue, because I agree with you. I think we do think that it is less of an issue because we haven't seen the cases. This is a little, it's a little difficult for me to talk about this, but I'll just do it. So my sense is that there are lots of needs. There's a lot of medical and mental and emotional and economic needs that exist in all trans people, right? And including trans men. And I think that we need to focus on the issues that we know of exist with trans men. So we need to advocate for access to mental health services, for example, not related to GID, but related to depression or related to, dealing with stigma. Because, my sense is that rather than focusing time on a redesign of GID, we should come up with a diagnostic criteria for society that has problems with trans people and then just give them a diagnosis. But I would like to focus our resources on the issues that we're aware of, right? So we know, for example, that trans men can have issues around accessing genital, exams, right? So we should make sure that there are clinics where gynecologists are trained in meeting trans men's needs, right? And that they have access to pap smears and pelvic exams and a whole range. If you have a body part, you have to take care of that body part. You can call it whatever you want, right? But you have to take care of it. The one person on the DVD said the junk. You have to take care of the junk. Because if you don't take care of the junk, you're not going to keep the junk. And you may not want to get rid of it. So I think, we have to advocate for provision of quality care for the things that we know about. And we know that trans men have, continued gynecologic needs. We know that. We know that Trans men's quality of lives are enhanced when they are provided with testosterone. The quality of life improves. You know, Emily Newfield did a study here in San Francisco, well, not just San Francisco, it was an internet-based study. And you know, she proved that if you had access to the medical and, the therapeutic technologies, that your quality of life improved and that your, sense of self, was at peace. And so we need to focus our resources on that. We do need to not exclude trans men from HIV prevention services. And I think that the appropriate setting for that would be in HIV AIDS programs that serve men, because that's where trans men will feel comfortable seeking services. They don't want to go and, hang out with a bunch of tranny girls. I mean, to learn about HIV prevention. We're not engaging in the same sexual practices or, behaviors necessarily. Some of us may be, but by and large, we're not. So I think that I want to advocate for provision of trans men HIV prevention services through traditional MSM serving HIV programs. And I want to advocate for carving out programs for trans women specific to trans women, because our needs are very specific.
It's been very enlightening.
Well, you can ask me.
No, the part I don't understand, the question is, how do you take this subject away from the hot button areas of gays, of marriage, of this, the whole homophobic community? How do you take this out and address it? Because as I listen to this, it's a whole different subject, a whole different area of viewing people. Mm-hmm. How do you separate this? Because how do you get this area out and give it the importance that you described?
That's a very good question. I think from a historical perspective, it's important to note that trans people, were at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. They were at the beginning of the gay liberation movement. You know, when you think about Stonewall, we always think about Stonewall as the start of the gay liberation movement, but it was a bunch of drag queens that were out there, involved in the struggle in that bar. And so, so trans people have been there since the beginning. I think one of the things that has happened, and we got a rude reminder of that when ENDA was introduced, without the inclusion of trans identities. So ENDA is the Employment Non-Discrimination Act that had been in committee for years in Congress, right? And there was some thought before the Bush administration left that the time was right to introduce ENDA, and that there would be some possibility of passing ENDA if the gender identity inclusion was removed. Okay, and so HRC, which is the nation's largest so-called advocate for LGBT populations, based in Washington, D.C., a lobby organization, they get millions of dollars from the LGBT community. They decided that that was okay to pursue ENDA without gender identity being included. So the very people that are the most likely to experience job discrimination, those people that are non-gender conforming, regardless of their sexual orientation, are going to be the highest at risk for job discrimination, because, you stand out, right? So HRC, advocated for passing this non-inclusive legislation. Well, there was a backlash. There was a lot of LGBT organizations actually came to our defense, and they proved that they were good allies not like HRC. And now HRC has come around and, you know, made their apologies, has tried to come and connect with the trans communities. But I think rather than saying, how do we remove this from the LGBT discourse, right, the hot button issues, I think what we need to do is think about ways in which we can have all of our needs and all of our issues be hot button issues, because I think that each one of those letters stands for a community of people that have needs and that have important and emergent needs. It's just like we talk a lot about gay and lesbian needs, but we never talk about bisexual people and their needs, you know, and they have needs too. And so I think that we need to recognize which needs are, you know, important to which part of our community. And if we're going to stand together, then, you know, we strength in numbers is, you know, the old adage. So if we're going to stand together, we can't let anybody behind. And so that ENDA battle was a real good reminder of that. That, you know, if part of the community moves forward without all of us, that community is splintered and we can't stand alone. Did I answer your question?
Well, it's a tough one to answer. Yes, you would like me.
Well, thank you for. Oh.
I do have one.
Okay.
I want to know about the frequency of transgender.
The what?
The frequency of transgender within the general population.
Right. Well, that's another good question. We don't really have a sense, and I'll tell you why we don't have a sense. We do have some numbers from overseas, actually. You know, so if we look at the data from the Netherlands, you know. And from Denmark, you know. So we look at those countries where they've been kind of keeping track of this for a lot longer than we have. You know, let's say 1 in 30,000, you know, male men, you know, have, you know, some trans sense of self. And, you know, somewhat lower numbers for trans, for male women, for non-trans women. No, I'm saying that wrong. For male women, who identifies trans men. So something like 1 in 10,000, I think it is, or 1 in something like that. But the numbers that we have in this country are based on pathology. So they're based on, like, you know, how many people get treated for GID, for gender identity disorder, or how many people have had surgical reassignment in this country. So some kind of medical intervention. And so if we know of, like, you know, that they've had some kind of medical procedure or so, or like in San Francisco's case, we know how many people, trans people, are living in San Francisco with HIV, right? Because the city has kept that, those numbers. So we know based on pathology, but we don't know based on something like a census or something like, you know, a national, you know, a population-based study, which is, you know, something that we could use in this country. There's ranges that people use. Like, for example, here in San Francisco, the estimate is supposed to be about 15,000. I've heard ranges, you know, around 15,000 to 20,000, which would be, you know, kind of interesting if it was, you know, if it was that many in San Francisco. Now, there's also a colleague, Lynn Conway, who has a website, and she estimates about 2 to 3 million people in this country, which I don't agree with. I think that's a gross overestimation. So, you know, those are the ranges that we know of. I'm advocating for a population-based study. I think, you know, it would be interesting. And certainly the CDC started keeping track of, you know, what's going on around the country, then we'd have a better sense. Do you want to add anything, Don?
No, but it would be useful if we can identify those physicians who conduct
think it would add to the data, but, you know, again, it's based on seeking some kind of intervention, right? So it's still problematic.
What about the 2010 census?
Pardon me?
What about the 2010 census?
Yeah, that's one.
I mean, it's one question. Do you identify as trans?
Right.
And you have the gender,
right.
And you have the whole thing.
Right.
Are people brave enough to actually, it's anonymous.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, when we did the staff survey at UCSF, and it was very interesting because, you know, I like to think that I know every trans person at UCSF. I hired most of them. but it turns out that we did a staff survey, and one of the questions was, you know, not that I advocate for this question because we have our own data collection recommendations, okay? And I'll share with you what those are. But in that survey, there was an option for other, right? So there's male, female, other on this survey that was done. And 170-something people chose other. So that's interesting, you know? That's interesting at UC. So now, in terms of our data collection recommendations, that we do have a policy recommendation that is on our website. You can look it up. And we recommend a two-question data collection system. Okay, so we recommend that first you ask the person's current gender identity, and you give them the ability to, you know, choose male, female, and then I can't recall what the other options are, but, you know, you ask the person's current gender identity, right? And then the second part of the question is, what was the sex that was assigned to you at birth? So you ask them first to disclose what their current gender identity is, right? And then the second question is around, you know, the sex assigned at birth. And if there's an incongruence there, that tells you that the person is trans-identified. Now, you're not boxing the person into any kind of identity. You do have, that's one of the options is a self-identifier. So you do have the ability to write in what your identity is. And that's it. We're advocating for that through HIV/AIDS service programs, and we're also advocating that the city adopt that so that we have a better sense of, at least here in San Francisco, you know, how many trans people actually exist. Well, thank you so much for spending the hour and 20 minutes with me, and I hope that this talk was, you know, informative and met your learning needs tonight. And if I can provide you with any additional information, please feel free to contact me. My contact information is on our website, transhealth.ucsf.edu. And have a great Thursday night.
Our thanks to Joanne Keatley for her comments here today. We also thank our audience here, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 106th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.